KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Word of Joe Biden's cancer diagnosis has unleashed a flood of well wishes and sympathy. It has also unleashed new questions about the state of his health as he ran for a second term as president.
It's Monday, May 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Last year, the U.S. tried to help Gaza by building a floating pier to deliver aid.
The mission flopped and led to one American soldier's death.
It was worth it. That's what he wanted to do. So yes, it was worth it.
Also ahead, we'll meet the winner of Nature Magazine's Scientist at Work Photography Contest.
She caught a killer picture of a killer whale.
A killer whale surfacing, swimming towards the fishing boat. I had no clue the whale was in that shot.
And a few tips from a personal finance expert on how to best navigate economic hardships in 2025.
That's all ahead after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump spent a chunk of today engaging in telephone diplomacy, having separate calls with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Trump saying in terms of winding down Russia's war with Ukraine, holding talks at the Vatican could give them extra significance and help things along. But Trump also acknowledged the leaders involved have to come to an agreement.
Big egos involved, I tell you. Big egos involved, but I think something's going to happen. And if it doesn't, I'd just back away and they're going to have to keep going.
Trump at one point called it a European situation. The president declined to say what would prompt him to walk away from his efforts to broker an end to the war, but has indicated his frustration with both sides in the past. Authorities in Southern California continue their investigation into the car bomb that badly damaged a fertility clinic in Palm Springs over the weekend, injuring four people. NPR's Jason DeRose reports police are now easing restrictions on evacuated areas.
After more than 48 hours of strict road closures in a large area around the blast site, police in Palm Springs are allowing traffic to move more freely. A car bomb late Saturday morning nearly destroyed the American Reproductive Center's clinic here. The explosion sent debris flying and blew out windows in buildings for blocks around. Meanwhile, about an hour northeast of Palm Springs in the town of 29 Palms, law enforcement is beginning to allow residents evacuated there to return home. The primary suspect in the bombing, Guy Edward Bartkus, died in the blast. He's associated with a home in 29 Palms that legal records show may belong to his mother. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Palm Springs, California.
Severe storms and tornadoes have killed more than two dozen people in the central U.S., at least 19 people in Kentucky alone. As survivors work to clean up the debris, more severe weather is in the forecast. From member station WEKU, Stan Ingold reports.
The days following the storm have been calm, allowing crews and survivors to continue working on picking up the pieces of their homes and communities. That's about to change as the National Weather Service in Jackson, Kentucky is predicting more severe weather Tuesday afternoon into Tuesday night. Chuck Greif is a senior meteorologist at the Jackson office.
The tornado potential will be less than what we saw with the last system that went through there, but it is not zero, and it probably will be a little higher than it normally is for these situations.
Greif says they have enough staffing to cover events like this. For NPR News, I'm Stan Ingold in Richmond, Kentucky.
National Weather Service is warning of more dangerous weather conditions in the days ahead, with the risk of tornadoes from Oklahoma, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee. Stocks closed mostly higher on Wall Street today as investors mull over the latest sovereign debt downgrade and continue to look at how consumers could be affected by the Trump administration's tariffs. The Dow was up 137 points today. The Nasdaq rose 4 points. The S&P 500 was up 5 points. You're listening to NPR. President Trump hosts the board of the Kennedy Center at the White House tonight, indication of how much time Trump is apparently devoting to remaking one of the nation's premier cultural institutions. Tonight's meeting of the center's board of trustees follows the firing of the board's previous members and the announcement Trump will serve as chair. The president has sought to mold the Kennedy Center in his own image with a different focus. CBS News Chief Wendy McMahon is resigning, saying she does not agree with corporate leadership on, quote, the path forward. NPR's David Folkenflik reports the company is in talks to settle President Trump's lawsuit over a 60-minute special.
Trump sued the network last fall as a private citizen after it aired an interview with his rival, then-Vice President Kamala Harris. CBS broadcast two versions of an answer she gave about the war in Gaza, a shorter one on Face the Nation and a longer one on 60 Minutes. Trump claimed that amounted to election election fraud. Legal experts tell NPR that Trump has a weak case thanks to the First Amendment's free speech protections. McMahon has opposed any settlement involving an apology. But CBS's owner is trying to complete a sale, one that requires the approval of the Federal Communications Commission, which is led by a Trump ally. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
A vanishing species of whale appears to be giving birth to fewer babies, heightening concerns about the survivability of the animals. Scientists said the right whale continues to see its numbers fall. Currently, it's believed there are only about 370 of the whales left. Right whales give birth off the southeastern U.S. coast. Authorities say they found this year only around 11 mother-calf pairs. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
KUAC wishes a very happy birthday to KUAC Kids Club members. Grace, Catherine, Rain, Penny, Izzy, Hendrix, Kelson, Madison, Theo, and Lily. Happy May birthday. Learn more at KUAC.org. KUAC Kids Club is sponsored by Alaska 529. One plan, many paths.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Joe Biden has stage 4 metastatic prostate cancer. The former president made that announcement Sunday afternoon, and it came just days before the publication of Original Sin, President Biden's decline, its cover-up, and his disastrous choice to run again, an explosive book by journalists Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson. Original Sin chronicles what the authors say was Biden's steep physical and cognitive decline, something that Tapper told my co-host Scott Detrow struck him during last summer's presidential debate, a debate Tapper moderated.
Dana Bash, my co-moderator, and I had these iPads so that we could write to the people in the control room, because obviously we can't talk to them and there was only one or two commercial breaks. And I wrote, holy smokes. Like during that first rambling, awful non-answer where he said we finally beat Medicare.
Making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do dealing with everything we have to do with, if we finally beat Medicare.
I just couldn't believe it. Look, I mean, we had all seen him aging. We had all seen him tripping and misspeaking. We had all seen evidence of decline, but the Biden team, family and senior advisors, were telling everybody, not just media, not just the public, but also Democratic donors and members of Congress, their own cabinet, he's fine, he's fine, he's fine, he's fine.
It's the second part of that statement, everyone around Biden insisting he was fine, that prompted Tapper and Thompson to report and write the book. The reporters spoke to my co-host Scott Detrow about the book and what they learned when they interviewed some 200 people, including cabinet members and Democratic members of Congress.
I want to talk about the hiding, as you frame it. Use the word cover up in the title. That's gotten a lot of attention. It's a strong phrase to use. Tell me why you justified using that framing when it came to President Biden's inner circle and the way that they protected him.
If it wasn't a cover-up, then why were so many people surprised by the debate?
Mm-hmm.
Beginning in fall of 2023, our reporting shows, based on the interviews with over 200 people, that there were two Bidens. There was a functioning Biden and a non-functioning Biden. And that goes back to, 2019, but it was almost always functioning Biden. But yeah. Beginning in 2023, the ratio of that functioning and non-functioning starts to change dramatically. And also non-functioning Biden is getting worse. And the White House, the people around them, we had one senior White House official who left because they were upset over what was happening and didn't think he should be running for re-election.
And when you say non-functioning, what's the best way to define that?
I would describe it as unable to come up with the names of top advisors or close friends. I would say, we're all human. We all forget names. We all lose our train of thought. We're not talking about that. And also, we all witness that in people who are aging. I mean, again, I'm not talking about that. We're talking about to the point of you are not able to have a conversation. You are not able to come up with data, information, knowledge, names that you should have at the ready. When he didn't recognize George Clooney, that is somebody who is not only somebody he'd known for more than 15 years, not only somebody that he had had serious conversations about Darfur with, not only somebody that had raised millions of dollars for him and was co-hosting that very fundraiser, he's also one of the most recognizable people in the world. So I'm talking about that. I'm talking about what we saw at the debate. Mm-hmm. Like that non-functioning Biden, I cannot articulate a sentence Biden.
You were talking about the framing of the cover-up, though, because it's odd, though. On one hand, he's the president of the United States. He's making a couple appearances of a day. You know, some days he didn't make that many of appearances, but he's giving speeches. He's appearing in public. Mm-hmm. He's carrying out the duties of the presidency. And yet, as you reported, there is a concerted effort to wall him off. What specifically was that circle of aides doing?
Yeah, I mean, the one top aide who left the White House said that they intentionally shielded him from other members of the administration, other members of the cabinet, other senior White House officials. The inner circle became smaller and smaller, and this White House official said that was intentional so that they did not realize the extent of the decline. You also saw the schedule become much tighter and more restricted. We have months of internal schedules that show that he would go up to the residence and have dinner at 4, 4:30, 5. Other members of the administration also said that he just would go up to the residence very, very early, and they would just wouldn't see him after a certain point of the day. And the schedule just became much more oriented about making sure that the public did not, and other aides did not see non-functioning Biden. And that's why the schedule became much more 10 to 4, and why, yes, he was doing those events, but they were often put in the middle of the day when those were his good hours.
Enough of the book is out that you're getting a response. I want to read you one quote that we have from Biden's camp, and I want to get your response. Mm. We're still waiting for someone, anyone, to point out where Joe Biden had to make a presidential decision or make a presidential address where he was unable to do his job because of mental decline. What's your response to that?
I mean, okay, first of all, that is setting the bar really low. That's their defense of our book. Where's the decision making that was the wrong decision? Well,
I guess it's the key question for the president of the United States, though, right? Like, can this person make that key decision in that moment?
Look, one of his most loyal top aides said to me, if the presidency is about two things, making decisions and being able to communicate those decisions to the American people, this person said he was always good at making the decisions. He could never effectively communicate it, and it got worse and worse throughout his term. So I don't buy the idea that the president is just some like magic eight ball. He just has to make decisions after the other, and he doesn't have to do anything else. So that to me is just a false premise. But beyond that, the book does describe situations where U.S. senators are very concerned about their interactions with President Biden. I'll just give you one. There is an incident in June 2024. President Biden has a meeting at the White House, an event having to deal with immigration. And everybody listening, I ask you to go to Google and watch this moment. Biden has some sort of glitch while talking that neurologists told us was some sort of neurological event. They don't know what it was, but it was some sort of neurological event. It wasn't a stutter. It was something else. And Senator Bennett from Colorado, loyal Biden-supporting Democrat, leaves that immigration event at the White House thinking, well, this is why the immigration policy in this country is so messed up. This president can't manage the portfolio. So I reject the premise, but even if we're using that premise, I don't buy it. Mm-hmm. It's not true. They haven't read the book yet, and that's fine. I wouldn't read it if I were them either.
That's Original Sin authors Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson. In another part of the program, the pair discusses how Biden's inner circle thought about the decision to run for a second term.
I was interviewing a longtime Biden aide, and they're quoted in the book as saying, I'm paraphrasing here, all he had to do was win, then he could have disappeared for the next 4 years and only had to occasionally show proof of life.
Nature magazine has announced the results of its annual Scientist at Work photography contest. NPR's Ari Daniel says the winning entries are dramatic and intimate portraits of research.
It was 2020 in the Norwegian Arctic, a season when the sun never peaks above the horizon.
It's one of the most beautiful times. It'll be like a sunset, but for hours.
Emma Vogel is a spatial ecologist at the University of Tromsø, and she studies how whales interact with fisheries. One morning, she was in a small boat with her then supervisor motoring into the fjord.
Sometimes you'll start to hear the whales before you can see them. And if you're downwind from that, you definitely smell their fish breath. Yeah, not the best.
During a moment of relative calm, Vogel took her camera and captured the riveting scene aboard her little boat.
In the center of the photo, you see my supervisor, and he's in this bright yellow survival suit, sitting with his headlamp on, just kind of looking into the distance.
Behind him is a large fishing boat, its crew on deck. There are hundreds of seagulls wheeling about, anticipating the imminent haul of fish.
The background is really beautiful, snow-covered mountains.
And in the distance, you can just make out
a killer whale surfacing, swimming towards the fishing boat. I had no clue the whale was in that shot, yeah. It gives me a feeling of a dream-like state.
To Vogel, this image captures the patient intensity of fieldwork. It won the overall prize from Nature magazine. The other winners were just as striking. In one, a scientist kneels in a forest, beaming at eight tiny frogs in her hands. In another, a researcher crouches atop a foggy Greek mountain, measuring the cloud forming around him. And then there's the photo taken in Siberia at midnight, outside a little cabin.
And I find, wow, what a beautiful night, and I just capture this image.
Jiayi Wang is a geology PhD student at the China University of Geosciences. He studies gold deposits and why they form. Wang's photo is mostly the night sky, dripping with stars. The landscape is a silhouette at the bottom, with the cabin in the middle. It casts light upon a single human form in the doorway, one person alone in the cosmos.
So many geologists, they have to go for fieldwork maybe 10 months a year. They spend little time with their families.
Wang's parents discouraged him from geology for exactly this reason.
But I still insist because I love science.
A love that so far has actually provided him with good friendships and stunning new places to photograph. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Well, the story about the Arctic light really struck a chord with those of us who live in those light conditions up here. Looking at the forecast for tonight here in the Arctic, or subarctic, I guess it would be. Tonight, scattered showers for Fairbanks and vicinity. Cloudy skies with lows around 43 degrees. Tomorrow, scattered showers, mostly cloudy skies, and highs near 59. Tomorrow night, isolated showers, mostly cloudy skies, and lows around 43. Currently in Fairbanks, calm winds, overcast skies, and 57 degrees. Looking at the pollen counts as of May 18th, as of yesterday, aspen and poplar are in the low range, willow is in the moderate range, and alder at 424 and birch at 906 are in the high range for both alder and birch pollen. Susan Harry's pollen counts are provided by One Tree Alaska with help from the UAF Cooperative Extension. And from the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, today's fire danger from the Fairbanks Fire Protection Agency is high. Small and large scale burning permits are required for Salcher Rail Belt and Fairbanks area, but burning is allowed today with a permit. More information at dnr.alaska.gov. Got more All Things Considered just ahead here on KUAC. It's Monday, May 19th. For KUAC, I'm Lori Neufeld. It's 420.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As Saturday Night Live capped its 50th anniversary season this weekend, guest host Scarlett Johansson set up a musical joke about cast member Sarah Sherman leaving the show.
It's been a great season and Sarah is leaving.
We're all gonna miss you next year.
Wait, what? Did you guys hear something?
Okay, Sarah Sherman is not actually leaving SNL, we don't think, not as far as we know. But the season finale did leave lots of questions about the future of the show, questions which NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to help answer. Hey there.
Hey.
Okay, so Sarah Sherman, we think, can sleep easy tonight. But as you wrote on NPR.org, there are all kinds of rumors about who might go. The big ones focusing on Weekend Update anchors Colin Jost and Michael Che. Did any bombs drop that anyone is leaving when they got to this episode Saturday?
No, and I think that joke about Sherman was probably a nod to the way that some of these SNL obsessives, okay, TV nerds like me, look at this season finale episode for clues if somebody might be leaving. In particular, I think people were looking at Jost and Che because they've now been doing SNL's newscast parody longer than anybody, more than 10 years. Che always jokes about leaving the show, and Jost's wife is Scarlett Johansson, who was hosting Saturday, as we said, so it might have been a good time to announce their departure, but instead they delivered a typical update segment which ended with a tradition. Jost and Che forced to read jokes written by each other, and Che wound up reading a Jost-written apology for lines that he wrote in a previous episode about Jost and Johansson. Let's listen.
You know, last time we did joke swap, I made Colin do some tasteless jokes.
Yes, I remember that.
Well, the fact is I was just lashing out because I'm jealous.
And that was about the only lines from that swap that we can actually air on radio. So I do have to say, if Che and Jost do leave, I would love for them to consider as a successor Daily Show correspondent Josh Johnson, who is building a great career as a prolific stand-up comic on social media.
Okay. Another thing you noted, your view, Eric, is that this season most of the political sketches just didn't land. Say more.
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't really been in love with a lot of their political parodies this season. They did have this great pre-tape sketch called The White POTUS, where they cast people from President Trump's administration as characters in the HBO show The White Lotus. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that sketch drew criticism from Amy Lou Wood, one of the stars of The White Lotus, for making fun of her appearance, and it sparked a lot of headlines. Now, it did show that SNL could stay in the news outside of those 50th anniversary events, but I still think SNL relies too much for political satire on James Austin Johnson's amazing Trump impression.
Amazing indeed. Speaking of the 50th anniversary events, I guess the big question for any show that's been around 50 years is it still relevant? You say yes. Why?
Well, one reason, you know, they were boosted by a season that successfully recognized this 50th anniversary, and they really seem to have people talking about the show again. They also had some really consistent entertaining episodes outside of all that anniversary stuff, mm-hmm. with hosts like John Hamm and Jack Black. It's quieted speculation about whether longtime executive producer Lorne Michaels, who is age 80, will retire. Now, as a TV nerd, I gotta point out the show won't actually turn 50 years old until October, because it debuted on October 11th, 1975. Still, I think SNL could make its episodes more consistent, and maybe they'll find they're better off satirizing pop culture more than political events, which moves so fast nowadays.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
And NPR TV critic Eric Deggans.
A little over a year ago, President Biden announced that the U.S. would undertake an ambitious project to rush aid into Gaza, a floating pier that would provide much-needed food to a civilian population facing potential famine. But that project was largely unsuccessful, and a U.S. service member died as a result of the undertaking. Now new details are emerging about that death, as well as the troubled U.S. effort. Steve Walsh with WHRO in Norfolk joins us with more. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Juana.
So, Steve, I recall that there were really problems from the start with this pier project. So could you just remind us how it came about?
So the idea was to find alternative ways to get food and other aid into Gaza after the Israeli government dramatically slowed down the amount of aid that was getting into the region through land crossings. Prior to this, the U.S. was dropping food aid by plane with limited success. Army boats set sail from Virginia in March to build a mobile pier system. There was debate within the Pentagon and with USAID about whether this whole thing would work, providing up to 150 truckloads a day of aid. In the end, it only provided a fraction of that.
Let's turn to the accident now. I understand that you were able to get a copy of the Army's report about it. What did it find?
Well, it happened inside the massive cargo ship USNS Bonavides. The report describes a forklift driver as racing down a ramp when it struck Sergeant Quandarius Stanley. This happened overnight. The mission requirements kept changing. Just after midnight, the soldiers were ordered to load another 66 pallets into trucks by 6 a.m., which is a tremendous amount. The report says the forklift driver was going more than double the recommended speed when the forklift struck Stanley. The driver says they just didn't see him. They could only make out the top of his head, but it was too late.
Okay. Now, a number of humanitarian organizations criticized the Pier Project, basically saying it was a distraction from more serious efforts to open land crossings into Gaza. What does the report have to say about the project's effectiveness?
Well, you know, there have been a couple reports about this, and the pier system only operated for about 20 days and never came close to the goals outlined by the Biden administration. At least one frustrated soldier told investigators that no one seemed to care about the well-being of the rank-and-file soldiers loading cargo. The report also describes soldiers working 10-plus hours a day in an all-out effort to get as much humanitarian aid out the door and into Gaza as possible, despite the constant challenges.
Steve, take stock of the project if you can. I know that you talked to the mother of the soldier that was killed. How does she feel about the project?
Well, yeah, that's right. I spoke with Sergeant Stanley's mother, Anna Stanley. She hadn't been given a copy of the report, though she had heard from some of the details from his friends. This is what she told me.
Well, they should have had somebody walking in front or some kind of light, something flashed. You know, people were saying that it was dark up there. They couldn't really see. It was very chaotic.
Before leaving Virginia, the 23-year-old had reassured his mother that he would be okay. I asked her if she felt the mission was worth it.
It was worth it. That's what he wanted to do. Yes, it was worth it.
So, an ambitious effort, but the project fell far below expectations. In the end, the pier delivered enough aid to feed 450,000 people for about a month. It was the most high-profile effort by the Biden administration to feed the over 2 million people who remain on the brink of starvation in Gaza. But the report by the Department of Defense Inspector General on the pier raises a lot of questions, including whether the military has the equipment and personnel to even attempt an operation like this in the future.
WHRO Steve Walsh in Norfolk, Virginia. Thank you.
Thanks, Juana.
This is NPR News.
How is anxiety about U.S. government debt affecting the financial markets? We'll pursue that question and also hear a skeptical take on OpenAI.
It was founded as a research nonprofit for, as it said, the benefit of all of humanity.
How did OpenAI change? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
The next Morning Edition is tomorrow morning from 5 to 8 right here on KUAC. Support for KUAC comes from folks in Chapel Hill, Rocky Mount, Clemens, and Charlotte. Thanks for making your voices heard from North Carolina. Up next, we've got NPR News headlines, Fairbanks Daily News Minor Sportscast, and the Weather Almanac, all right ahead just here on KUAC.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, a rash of kidnappings by monkeys.
A group of capuchin monkeys are stealing the babies of another monkey species. The question is, why?
And I saw even more babies being carried by many different capuchins, and that it was no longer just this one individual doing something a little quirky.
Now news.
Welcome to the News Minor Sportscast. I'm Caleb Jones. It was a rivalry clash for the West Valley Wolfpack baseball team's senior day, as they hosted the Lathrop Malamutes for a doubleheader on Saturday. They defeated their rivals in both contests to secure a sweep, picking up their fourth and fifth consecutive wins. The results continue a turning point for West Valley, which opened the season with 11 straight losses, but have now rattled off 5 victories in a row to stand at 5-11. In the first game, it was a low-scoring start to the doubleheader, with Lathrop holding West Valley off the board until the bottom of the seventh. From there, the Wolfpack rallied for 3 runs in their half inning, walking off the Malamutes in a 3-2 win. The contest was dominated by pitching up until the final moments, but in the end, West Valley's persistence at the plate was a key quality in pulling out the win. Lathrop's Remy Derevivin nearly went the distance on the mound, pitching 6.2 innings, allowing just 3 hits and 3 earned runs with 13 strikeouts and 5 walks. All 3 runs for West Valley came in the bottom of the 7th with 2 outs in their last trip to the plate. After West Valley battled to tie the game, the final touches on the comeback win came from the hands of Bryson Roone, who, in a lengthy at-bat, delivered the game-winning single, bringing in Eli Taylor and sealing a 3-2 walk-off win for the Wolfpack. The second game provided much more scoring, seeing a combined 13 runs between the teams, as West Valley pulled away for the sweep in an 8-5 triumph. A back-and-forth game saw Lathrop jump ahead with their first run scored in the top of the first, followed by 3 for West Valley in the bottom of the second, and 2 more for the Malamutes in the top of the third. Following the back-and-forth start, West Valley started to pull away. A run in the bottom of the third, combined with a pair of scores in the bottom of the fourth and the sixth, saw them plate the game's 5 out of the last 7 runs scored. Both teams had their fair share of errors, with Lathrop at 8 and West Valley at 6, and both teams combined for 5 hits apiece. For the News Minor Sportscast, Caleb Jones.
The sex trafficking trial of Sean Diddy Combs continues in New York City. 3 witnesses took the stand today, as NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports. And a quick note here, this report contains mention of physical assault.
2 of the prosecution's witnesses testified that they saw Sean Combs violently beat his ex-girlfriend, Cassie Ventura. The first, Don Richard, is a singer who worked with Combs from 2004 to 2011. The second, Carrie Morgan, was Ventura's best friend for nearly 2 decades. Both say they witnessed Combs behaving violently toward Ventura on more than one occasion. Afterwards, a man named David James took the stand. He worked as a personal assistant for Combs from 2007 to 2009. James will continue testifying Tuesday about his experience as Combs' employee. The rapper and entrepreneur faces charges that include sex trafficking by coercion and racketeering conspiracy. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
The credit agency Moody's has stripped the federal government of its AAA bond rating. That could result in higher borrowing costs for consumers. The company warns that U.S. policymakers have failed to address a rising tide of government debt. All this comes as Republicans consider extending President Trump's tax cuts, which could add trillions to the national debt. On Wall Street, the tech-heavy NASDAQ added 4 points today. Little changed. This is NPR.
Today is Monday, May 19th. Sun rose this morning at 4:12 and will set at 11:24. Total length of day, 19 hours and 12 minutes. Tomorrow's will be 6 minutes and 54 seconds longer than today. Record high, 80 degrees in Fairbanks. That was just back in 2023. Record low, 20 degrees back in 1918. Our moon is in its third quarter, 55% illumination. Moon rose this morning at 4:29 and set at 10:43.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump spoke with Russian leader Vladimir Putin today and claimed he had made real progress toward ending the war in Ukraine.
It's a terrible situation going on over there. 5,000 young people every single week are being killed. So hopefully we did something.
President Trump has been calling for a ceasefire. President Putin suggested there was still more work to do. Trump also spoke with Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, and with the leaders of major European countries. Joining me now to talk through this is NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Hey, Charles.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Hey, so a day of a whole lot of telephone diplomacy by Trump. Start with the call between Trump and Putin. That one was so highly anticipated. What did we learn?
Yeah, you know, Trump and Putin spoke for just over 2 hours by phone. Putin was the first to give his take, calling the conversation useful, constructive, substantive. But for all those pleasantries, it was clear Putin hadn't agreed to the ceasefire Trump was after. Let's listen.
Russia выступает за мирное урегулирование украинского кризиса.
So here Putin says that Russia is for a peaceful settlement to the Ukraine crisis, but he adds we should determine the most effective path towards that peace. And he later spoke of establishing principles of a settlement, the timing of a peace agreement, among other details.
Okay, so not exactly signing on to an imminent ceasefire then. It's almost like I think I can hear the can clinking as these two kick it down the road. What was the Trump readout?
Well, like Putin, Trump was complimentary about the tone and spirit of the exchange, calling it excellent, but he was actually effusive about the results. In a post to social media, Trump said that Russia and Ukraine would immediately start negotiations towards a ceasefire and ending the war. He added the details would be negotiated directly between the two sides, quote, as it in only be. Trump also said he'd been informed key players, including Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and European partners about this, and suggested the Vatican may even host future negotiations, ending his post with, let the process begin, exclamation point.
So it sounds like the American readout is certainly the more positive of the two, but square that with the fact that it's the Trump administration has been suggesting they might walk if there isn't progress and fast.
Exactly. But now it seems like Trump is suggesting he might distance the U.S. from negotiations because this process that he claims is going so well. That said, Trump also made clear he had no intention of walking away from other deals with Russia. For one, Putin's advisor later told journalists Trump and Putin had discussed exchanging 9 prisoners from each side. That's 9 Americans arrested for low-level crimes, possibly coming home from Russian jails. Meanwhile, Trump also talked up the tremendous opportunities in Russia for business, calling the potential unlimited. And he said Ukraine could also benefit from trade as it rebuilds. Of course, detractors of the deal aren't quite so sure.
Charles, catch us up on another point, Europe. The Europeans have been threatening new sanctions against Russia if Putin didn't sign up to an immediate ceasefire. Do we know what happens to those?
Well, I assume they'll have to decide whether to give Russia more time to negotiate or not. Either way, the Kremlin's projecting confidence that can weather new penalties and that time is on its side on the battlefield.
And last thing, Ukraine. Wait, what is the Ukrainian take on all of this?
Well, President Zelensky of Ukraine took to social media to give his readout of the talk with Trump. He reaffirmed that Ukraine was ready for a ceasefire, but it said it was important not to dilute that proposal. The challenge for Zelensky is now avoiding any appearance of being seen by Trump as the greater obstacle not only to peace, but to other deals the American president clearly wants with the Kremlin.
And here's Charles Maines from Moscow. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
There's an old expression, monkey see, monkey do. It means copying someone's behavior without really understanding it. Well, recently, some monkeys started mimicking a disturbing habit developed by one member of their group. And as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, this is having some serious consequences for their neighbors.
All of these monkeys live in Panama on an island. There, a group of white-faced capuchin monkeys uses stone tools to crack open hard foods. Tool use is unusual for this species, so researchers have been studying them using a bunch of wildlife cameras. Zoe Goldsborough is with the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior and the University of Constance. She says the cameras collect a lot of video, and it all has to be reviewed.
And I was doing this when I stumbled upon this image of a capuchin carrying a howler monkey on its back.
A howler monkey? That's a different species, the only other primate living on the island. She says this was surprising. She and her colleagues wondered if this howler monkey baby had been abandoned and then got adopted.
And then after that, it sort of became this detective work of going through all the hundreds of thousands of images and videos to look for more of this happening.
It turns out there was more to find. That one particular young male, a capuchin they call Joker, didn't just get a hold of a single howler monkey infant. Over a few months, the video cameras saw him carrying four different howler babies around. Then Goldsborough went through video from the following months.
And I saw even more babies being carried by many different capuchins, and that it was no longer just this one individual doing something a little quirky.
Because the other young males in the group were copying the original kidnapper. In the journal Current Biology, the researchers report on seeing five young males carrying around a total of 11 howler monkey babies. Brendan Barrett is with the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior and is a research associate at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. He says their cameras saw several dead howler monkey babies, and the rest surely died too.
They're infants. The youngest one is a day or two old, so they need their mother's milk to survive. So they're likely probably dying from dehydration or lack of nutrition.
He says they don't have video of the actual baby snatching, so it's not clear how capuchins steal these infants from the much bigger howler monkeys or why they'd want to. But he notes that on this island, food is plentiful and there are no predators.
In some ways, it's something to do to pass the time in a kind of a boring environment where it's relatively safe to come up with these potentially risky innovations.
And while innovations like stone tools are useful, not every invention or new behavior has a purpose. Pointless fads like this can spread through a social group. Chimps have been seen sticking blades of grass in their ears like earrings. Orcas have been spotted wearing dead salmon on their heads like hats. Chris Krupenia is with Johns Hopkins University. He studies primate psychology, but wasn't part of this research team. He says it's known that capuchins can develop strange customs. In one group, for example, a monkey will stick a buddy's finger in their own eye as a kind of bonding activity.
So they show all kinds of weird cultural traditions that they seem to have picked up that include, you know, arbitrary ones like that.
He says this rash of kidnappings may be like that for the capuchins, while for the howler monkeys, it's tragic. The researchers want to understand how the howler monkeys react to this terrifying new threat and whether this fad will eventually disappear. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio will testify about the budget before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he used to be a member. He's likely to hear concern from his former colleagues, at least from Democrats, about the fate of America's soft power. The Trump administration has dismantled the U.S. Agency for International Development and is making dramatic changes at the State Department, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has been surprised by the way Rubio is running the State Department.
Yeah, I've been disappointed.
At a recent roundtable with reporters, Jean Shaheen talked about the drastic cuts in foreign aid programs and her conversations with former recipients in Poland and Ukraine who tell her they've lost faith in America.
I mean, you don't repair that just by turning the money back on. We have lost years of relationships, of trust in America.
Secretary Rubio has consistently said the U.S. will continue to carry out life-saving aid programs around the world, though without a specialized aid agency. USAID is now being folded into the State Department to be more aligned, he says, with the Trump administration's foreign policy goals. Republicans on the committee have backed the changes he's making, but Hawaii Democrat Brian Schott says this could have been done in a more thoughtful, bipartisan way.
So what I need, and what everybody needs, is Marco Rubio, from all of his career up until about 120 days ago, to reemerge, reassert himself, and save the enterprise.
Senator Schatz told an audience at the Council on Foreign Relations that he's not sure if this is a, quote, requiem or recess of America's leadership in the world. Shaheen, a Democrat from New Hampshire, says too much damage has been done, at least to America's aid efforts around the world.
I think a lot of it's gone, and it's not coming back anytime soon. And I think it undermines our national security. It undermines our position in the world. And ultimately, it makes Americans less safe.
The last time Rubio was before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was for his nomination hearing in January, where he hinted at big reforms, but also praised career Foreign Service officers.
My entire service on this committee, which spans 14 years, we always had fellows from the Department of State, I believe all of whom are still in the service of our country. And I intend, because I know them and I've worked with them, to utilize their skill sets in the department.
So far, the Trump administration has not nominated any career ambassadors, and Rubio is cutting staff by 15%. Just last week, the junior officer put in charge of personnel alarmed career diplomats by canceling promotion boards. The State Department says it's just picking the boards in a new way, not upending a system that is written in law. But Eric Rubin, who used to run the department's union, says Rubio seems to be driving career officials out.
It would take a serious biographer or a psychiatrist to explain why he's turned his back on so much of his previous career and his previous views, but right now he's all in.
Rubio is also in a far more influential position in the Trump administration, serving not just as Secretary of State, but also National Security Advisor, so he's likely to face many more questions about policy on Gaza, Ukraine, and China than on budget cuts. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:48, and you are tuned to KUAC 89.9 FM. And KUAC is supported by Save Our Domes, providing local residents with information about large-scale mining development in the Fairbanks area. More at saveourdomes.org. Come up tonight on KUAC television and streaming at kuac.org. PBS NewsHour is at 6. At 7, it's Antiques Roadshow, Junk in the Trunk 14. Watch newly revealed treasures from all five stops of Roadshow's Season 29 tour. Then at 8, it's American Experience, followed by Independent Lens at 9. Then at 10, come back anytime. Get a heartwarming reminder of the pleasure of delicious meals with ramen master Masamoto Oyada. And at 11, it's Almond Poor and Company. That's all tonight on KUAC TV 9.1 and streaming on both the PBS app and at the KUAC app. Just click on Watch Live on those apps. Tonight, Fairbanks and vicinity can expect scattered showers. In the hills, maybe numerous rain showers. and lows around 43. Northwest winds around 5 miles per hour. And tomorrow, scattered showers, mostly cloudy skies, highs near 51 tomorrow. Highs near 59 tomorrow for Fairbanks and vicinity. Got more All Things Considered just ahead.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today, President Trump signed the Take It Down Act, which tightens rules around what is known as revenge porn. Lisa Autry from member station WKYU met one Kentucky family that hopes the law will help others avoid the loss of a loved one. And a warning, this story discusses suicide.
Family and friends describe 16-year-old Eli Heacock as a prankster who lit up a room. He was close to getting his driver's license. On February 28th, his mother, Shannon Heacock, picked him up from school and surprised him with a new Jeep.
He was ecstatic. We drove, and actually he held my hand as we were switching gears so I could show him how to do a 5-speed.
At 11:30 that night, his mom says Eli was found on the floor of the laundry room, a gun lying next to his feet. The sheriff's office says his death was ruled self-inflicted. The gun belonged to his family. The teen used it to target shoot in the backyard, a common practice in rural Kentucky. His dad, John Burnett, says investigators found his son was not a depressed kid.
Even the cops told us he was a well-adjusted young man. He had tennis, he had track. He was excited about all these things.
The family says during a search of Eli's phone, investigators found AI-generated images of the young man. According to the Heacocks, the FBI is investigating possible sextortion in the case because of a threat to release the pictures unless he paid $3,000. His best friend, Harrison Ely, recalls Eli texting him that night asking to borrow money.
Which I didn't know what it was about, but I only had $8 on my Cash App at the time. I didn't think nothing of it. I fell asleep and I woke up and I checked my phone. And the last message I got from him was, I love you so much. And that kind of still hits me hard.
The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children received more than 26,000 reports of financial sextortion in 2023, up from just over 10,000 the previous year. Today, the Heacock family visited the White House for the signing of the Take It Down Act. The new national law will make it a crime to publish or threaten to publish non-consensual intimate photos, whether real or fake. Online platforms would also be required to remove content within 48 hours of a victim contacting them.
The bill is very likely to result in the takedown of content that is well outside of its intended target.
Becca Branham is with the Center for Democracy and Technology. They fear the law could be weaponized. For example, they say if someone wants to take down political speech, they could use the law to bombard social media platforms with takedown requests. And because of the 48-hour requirement, social media platforms may default to just pulling content down.
And those unintended consequences are really going to matter when the bill is inevitably challenged on First Amendment grounds.
Opponents say there should be penalties for making a false report, and the law contains no such provision. Meanwhile, Kentucky enacted a new law in March making sextortion a felony. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Autry in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, contact the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by dialing 988.
As of May 5th, the Department of Education has resumed collecting on defaulted student loans. Borrowers had a long stretch where they didn't have to worry about the monthly hits to their budgets. It started during the coronavirus pandemic and was extended during the Biden presidency. But now that the payment holiday is over, the bills are due and the timing, it can be tricky. Groceries cost a lot more now than they did in 2020, and so does housing. Tariff disputes make it hard to plan future purchases. So for some help with our personal finances, we've called up Mandy Woodruff Santos. She's a longtime financial journalist, and she's the host of the Brown Ambition podcast, a weekly money and career podcast. Mandy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I want to start off with talking about these federal student loans. And before we get into all the details of these payment plans, I just have sort of a basic practical question. How do you plan for something new, a new expense that you weren't necessarily prepared for?
So if your budget is already really thin, if you've already given up your DoorDashes, your Ubers, if you have canceled your Netflix subscription, if you can't possibly reduce any other expenses, then maybe you're looking at taking on freelance or contracting work to increase your income, hoping and asking for a raise at work to increase your income. When you've exhausted those options, there actually are flexible repayment plan options.
Can you break some of them down for us just as simply as you can?
It's really complicated. You know, I put them in a couple of buckets. There's a couple of plans where you can pay off your loans over the course of 10 years. If you do nothing, you're probably on one of these plans. Now, that monthly payment may be way too much. And in that case, you want to go to your second bucket, income-based repayment options. These plans are going to give you an extended timeline to pay back your loans. And they have this carrot that they're dangling at the end of it, which is everyone's favorite word, forgiveness. Mm-hmm. After 20 to 25 years, these plans have some sort of promise that you will become eligible to have your entire balance forgiven. And they're going to make your monthly payments more in line with what you can actually afford. And it's often one of the options that I recommend people go for first before they go to their next bucket of opportunities, which is something like deferment or forbearance, where you're sort of kicking the can down the road and not eligible for forgiveness.
Okay, so here's a question I have. Say you've already made a choice. You've opted into one of these sort of buckets of repayment plans, and you look and you see there might be a better option out there for you. Is a person able to change their mind and pick a different one?
Absolutely. I mean, it may not happen overnight, but you can go to studentaid.gov, find out which loan servicer to call up. And I highly encourage you to get on the phone and talk to a human as much as you can and tell them what's happened so that you can apply for a different plan.
Okay, so that's student loans. And I want to move to a different topic here. We know that when times get tough for many of us where money may be a little tight, many of us, we turn to credit cards to rely on. Any tips on how to manage it? Because I mean, for many people, paying off the principal just might not be an option right now, you know?
For many people, paying off the principal isn't an option. But if you're looking at these balances and your minimum payments and you do not have the money in your budget to make them, then it's time to look at some alternative options. I often talk to people about balance transfers, and balance transfers is when you get another credit card who's like, sure, Juana, I'll take that $5,000 mm-hmm. off your Chase credit card, and we're going to offer you a 0% intro APR for, let's say, 12 months. And that can feel like a huge relief. If you are someone who probably can't pay down your balances, if you were to even get an intro APR, then you have other options. You can look at a debt consolidation loan. And I love a credit union. Absolutely shop and compare to get the best rate. But they'll give you a lump sum. Then you'll have one fixed monthly repayment amount that you have to focus on and a fixed interest rate.
Mandy, last thing before we let you go. I think anyone who's been through it knows that trying to navigate financial hardships can take a big toll emotionally, mentally, and physically. Sometimes it can feel like it's the only thing you can focus on and you can think about. I wonder, is there a word of advice you'd leave us with for people who are just trying to make it through this moment and figure it all out?
I'm so glad you asked me that question. I truly believe a lot of people don't need a financial advisor. They need a good mental health counselor, a therapist. You may need to make more friends, to build your community, invest in your relationships so that you can, you know, find out that you're not alone and feel that sense of support, or at least like you have someone to walk along with you on this journey.
We have been speaking with Mandy Woodruff Santos, financial journalist and host of the Brown Ambition podcast. Mandy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Juana. Thanks for having me.
It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.